back. WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are, it's baseball season. Play ball, they say, as the baseball strike ends. We're going to get back out onto the field. Luke Jones will be covering all things baseball on behalf of our friends at Royal Farms. Real fresh, real fast. I passed by one over the weekend, and they're not happy about the gas prices either. So we're not going to have that on this year program. We're going to be joyful and happy because the Orioles are going to play this year, Luke Jones, right? I mean, you and I spent long, long stretches of time, 90 days, discussing whether it was ever going to happen or not. I think there was a point where I don't know that I was cynical, but I wasn't really believing that they cared all that much to get on the field quickly. I thought it might have dragged on longer. It might have been more catastrophic than it wound up being.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. In fact, I even said when it got to the point we knew the original opening day was going to be pushed back, that felt like the moment where you rip off the Band-Aid and then both sides dig in their heels a little bit. And that really ended up not being the case. We said all along through this process, not that you and I were doing daily updates the first 7 weeks of this lockout. One, they didn't do any negotiating at that point, which is why you look back at this thing and say, really? All of this for pushing the season back a week? And you know, through that lens, it ends up not being as catastrophic for the sport in terms of the short term. Now, we could talk about the long term issues of baseball that we've talked about for years now, and we'll continue to do so. But in terms of how most fans view it, especially here specifically with the Orioles, where they are in the rebuild and where they are in signing players, not signing players at this point in time, waiting for Adley Rutschman and company to get to Baltimore, you certainly didn't have a lot of people plugged in and engaged with the offseason. So from that standpoint, I don't think the season being moved back from March 31st to April 7th has a ton of consequences in that way. But at the same time, I look at it and say, was this really worth what you ended up getting accomplished and missing a week of the season? And I think the players did well for some of the younger players, minimum salary. The pre-arbitration pool, I think, is a good start in terms of, you know, it's not terribly different from what you see in the NFL with the proven performance escalators that, you know, if you're a second or a third round pick, you can have your salary go up in year three and four. And we've seen that with a number of Ravens players over the years. So I like some of those elements. But again, this wasn't a CBA that had dramatic fundamental changes. And typically when you're talking about missing time and you go back to the 94-95 strike, of course, the owners wanted to implement a salary cap. So you didn't have anything that dramatic. The players did okay for them.
Which, by the way, 30 years later, and I was on the radio for all that, had they agreed to it and made it work, it would have been better for the players in the long haul. The players would have had a lot more power to make sure that the Orioles don't have a $22 million payroll, or that the Marlins didn't, or that any of those teams didn't. So in the end, the players in totality, the sport in totality, and I said this 30 years ago, you can go listen to the old tapes. They're on little cassette tapes. That is their cardinal sin. The cardinal sin of that sport has always been rich versus poor, and having some guy on the radio, like you say, but, you know, all these teams have made the playoffs and they've won the world. No, it's the perception that year after year, you're not going to go off the end of a cliff and have 7 years of rebuilding, and all the things that baseball has put itself in a corner, really, you know, right? Because hockey, NBA, NFL, cost certainty, good for owners, good for fans too. That's me being 50 and having gray beard here now. When I was prescient about that in the 90s, saying, hey, you want to have a good sport, have it be fair. Have it be fundamentally fair. Nobody wanted fair in baseball, so they get this.
Yeah, although I would say I think it's only been until very recently, talking the last 7, 8, 9 years, where you've just seen the luxury tax and the competitive balance thresholds really become more and more of a hard cap. But as you point out, and I think this is certainly where you've seen things change for the worse from the player's perspective, without actually having a real salary cap, you have no floor. I mean, in the NFL, you have to spend to what, 90% of the cap over a 4 or 5 year period. Might be 93%, something along those lines. I can't remember what the latest one was. But the point is, you can't have a $50 million payroll in the NFL. Like, you're just not allowed to do that.
In the old days, you thought there was a gentleman's agreement that they would be trying, or they needed to sell tickets. That the idea was, in order to make money, we have to be good. In order to be good, we have to do well. In order to be good is how we grow. It's how we sell more tickets. It's how we sell the business for more money later on. I don't know. That has not really – where you finish in the standings has had very little impact on any of that in the last three decades. Like, as far as value of franchises and the things that owners concern themselves with, not winning and losing, how much money we make. That's really what they're concerning themselves with. I don't know. In this fight, for all that it represented, I think what they really did was they cost themselves what we're about to see in the NFL, if you want to turn the conversation, which is the offseason, right? I mean, this is going to be the most exciting week. It already is. Tom Brady's back. Aaron Rodgers is back. Russell Wilson's over there. You know, Bobby Wagner might be over here. And you know, we get all this stuff going on, right? That's what baseball like lost for 4 months. It just said, we're not going to have an off season. Now we're going to have a shotgun start. We're going to have a half-assed spring training. So they've really disrupted their business in a way that probably isn't good in a good time either, given the last 2 years. So I would say that's the lingering effect of this. They disrupted their business. They disrupted the fans. The fans are all pissed. There's nobody happy about any of this from the fans' perspective. And I don't know that the players or the owners, anybody felt like they really won. To your point, players feel like they got some things, right? So at least there's that.
Yeah, and I mean, the one thing I would say is, other than the timing of this coinciding with NFL free agency starting specifically this week, if you kind of follow how MLB's off seasons have gone in recent years, though, it's been a slog. You know, it has not been like what you're going to see with the NFL throughout this week. It's not what you see in the NBA in early July when the free agency opens and it's nuts. Baseball's been much more of the waiting it out. And I mean, that's been the Scott Boras way, right? wait these out. Then guys are signing later and later in the offseason. So in that regard, I'll disagree with you a little bit. I think you're seeing, and you even saw over the weekend, a little more of a flurry of activity out of pure necessity, right? I mean, these guys need to get into camp.
Well, there's 15 teams in baseball not trying that aren't going to sign an Aaron Rodgers or Russell Wilson in their sport.
Right.
I mean,
but they work
these morons on the Orioles are going to sign Carlos Correa. I'm like, man, you people are really, really bored, naive, dumb. I don't know what to call it. But like, after all these years, I'm glad that that's not my phone calls. Like that, we're going to sign Carlos Correa. No, you're not. But in the NFL, you might. In the NFL, you might. And that's – you might sign Kirk Cousins if you're in D.C. You know, that might happen, really, right?
Yeah, although the NFL – I mean, Cincinnati Bengals have been notoriously cheap when it comes to free agency. I mean, you have other teams like the Ravens and the Steelers who typically don't play that game as much. And look, I'm talking about from a strategic standpoint, but I hear what you're saying. And there's certainly, I'm not going to disagree with it entirely. Again, I'll go back to the fact that through all the hand wringing, through as much of it that, as I thought was silly, where they really didn't begin to negotiate until late February. And you consider through that lens, it didn't take that long to hammer out a deal. Why didn't you start 3 weeks earlier than you did? And, you know, you could have proven the same point and pitchers and catchers could have reported on February 23rd rather than February 14th or whatever it ended up being.
Well, why didn't you start earlier? They don't like each other, right? I mean, really fundamentally, they don't like each other.
Well, and I mean, as we talked about this 2 years ago when it was such a fight just getting restarted in the midst of the pandemic. And but I'll continue to go back to what I said in previous conversations. So much of this for me from the player's perspective is really a failure and complacency in the last couple CBAs to let it get to this point. And then you look at it and say, oh, my gosh, I mean, we have so much revenue that's coming into the game, and yet player salaries have been stunted. They've stagnated. They've gone in the wrong direction over the last 5 years, even before the pandemic is taken into consideration. And, you know, but I'll go back to something you said, and this is fundamentally the biggest problem, and the sport's not going to have real change for the better. I mean, incremental things that we can certainly talk about, and there are a couple things I actually want to touch on that I think could be the start to helping the game in some ways in terms of play on the field. But fundamentally, when you have a high percentage of owners who aren't doing everything they can to compete, and in some cases not doing anything to really compete, that's bad. I mean, you know, and that's the Captain Obvious statement. But to your point, inherently, there's always been an expectation, whether you've been the Yankees or whether you've been a team like the Oakland A's over the last 25 years with Billy Beane and not having, you know, the same kind of budget that big market teams have necessarily. There's always still been that expectation that you're trying to win, that you're trying to compete. You might be doing it in a different way with Moneyball or what have you, but there's always that expectation for decades upon decades, whether it was true or not, mind you. I mean, we can all think back in baseball history. The Kansas City A's were notoriously known for being the Yankees farm system, for example. So it's always existed to some degree, but more than ever, that perception of teams not trying to win, I mean, that's really tough to get past. And I think that was one element of the lockout why you guys like you and me were so concerned to see it go on so long, because there was a perception that inherently only one side here really cares that much about missing games in April, potentially. You know, when you just look at it, the players are going to miss paychecks, the owners, and, you know, it's already been talked about in terms of, you know, what the requirements are with RSNs as far as the games being played. You know, you have to have a certain minimum, and knowing that attendance isn't good in April, there was very much a perception and probably a reality that the owners didn't care that much about missing some games in April. Now, the good thing is cooler heads prevailed, common sense prevailed. We're still going to have a 162 game season. It's a very easy fix to make up those, what, six games that were postponed. They're going to tack 3 days on to the end of the regular season, and they're going to schedule three doubleheaders. And that's fine. You know, that's not going to be any kind of major hardship. They get playoff expansion to 12 teams. I don't love it, but I like it. Certainly like it more than going to 14 teams. I think as much as we talk about wanting competition and teams to try to win, I don't think that answer is to lower the bar in terms of what it takes to get into the playoffs. To me, by the way that most owners have operated in recent years, that tells me, oh, I don't need to spend as much, and maybe 85 wins gets me into the playoffs rather than 90. So I'm glad not to see it expand to 14, although it'll go to 14 at some point, just like, you know, football is going to continue to expand. We'll have eight teams in the playoffs in each conference at some point here in the not too distant future. But again, in the end, pushing the season back a week, you know, 1990 had a similar thing happened. It's not going to resonate with a lot of fans, I think, at this point now with March Madness. I think most
Brady.
People, yeah, well, no, but the point is, in the sports calendar, even your most diehard baseball fans aren't necessarily living and dying with spring training results every day, right? I mean, you're kind of saying, okay, who's healthy? Who's pitching well? Who's off to a good start at the plate? But it's not the same thing as the regular season. So March Madness, in terms of sporting events, now NFL owns the news cycle still, and we saw that very much on Sunday evening with Tom Brady, as you mentioned. But March Madness, this is its time in the calendar. Once that's over, okay, it's baseball's time in the calendar. At least the sport will be on the field and they'll be playing, which is something that you said it and I agreed. I mean, I thought once it got to the point that they ripped off the Band-Aid knowing that opening day was going to be pushed back, I really thought it was going to be late April into May when we were actually going to see baseball. So I was glad to be wrong on that. But that said, still plenty of things that the sport, you know, from an on-field standpoint, let alone talking about the economics and, you know, CBT thresholds and the haves versus the have-nots and all of that, a lot of things that need to be done. But, you know, I think a few elements of the CBA I thought were interesting in terms of some rule changes. You know, you're going to have a lottery with the draft.
I was going to say, Luke's here, by the way. All of it brought to you by our friends at Coons Ford. Dennis is going to be here on Thursday from 3 until 5 as well. We have the Maryland Lottery Crab Cake Tour this week. We're at Costas watching Day 2 basketball. Nobody from Maryland in the tournament this year, so we're going to eat more crab cakes and drink beer. See you at Costas on Friday, too. Luke, before you go into those things, I wanted to give you this poignant question from Little Nestor over on Bank Street in Dundalk. What's in this for the fans? Like, what's the win here? How have they fixed the game from all of the problems that we've seen? Okay, players don't have to fly coach anymore. They don't have to stay at the Ramada anymore. They actually get they've had all that for 100 years. I mean, listening to the players and the media beating the band for the players and how big bad owners were and all of that. I read all of that. Everybody's pro player. So the players went in to fight on behalf of us to get us better things so we can have more playoff games and better cable things. And what did they give us? What's in this that's going to make it better for the fans?
Well, I mean, they didn't give the fans anything. The fans never get anything. The fans give. I mean, it's the classic, you know, you love your team and they ever really loved you back in the end. They love your money. They love your support, but my dad,
when I loved Kiss in 1978, I got Kiss Alive too. My dad said, Kiss doesn't care about you. And then I found out later in life, Paul Stanley was a wonderful man. So yes, it does happen sometimes, but with the Orioles,
I mean,
he told me the Orioles love me.
Well,
and that I should love them for all of my life.
You know, of course, that was a little bit of a cynical answer and a little bit of little tongue in cheek. But at the same time, I mean, you know, I said all along, I wasn't concerned about the players and certainly had no concern for the owners. But stadium workers, bars and restaurants at these 30 ballparks, all the seasonal employment opportunities, all those things were the things that, you know, you really looked at. Certainly Arizona and Florida are going to take a hit. In terms of these spring training communities. But, you know, in terms of things that I thought the CBA afforded that I think can make the game better, you know, I mentioned the fact that more younger players in terms of minimum salaries, in terms of the pre-arbitration bonus pool, I think those are good things. When you have
So Adley Rutschman comes up earlier or no?
Potentially. Now, a couple interesting things with service time. Now, do I think this went far enough? No. But as I mentioned in a kind of looking at it globalistically with the CBA and the player's perspective, you're not going to get everything you want in one CBA. It's incremental. In the same way that the luxury tax, when it was first implemented in 1997, I guess, when they actually got a new CBA in place, which is kind of crazy when you think about it, you know, all these years later, you know, the strike ends, you know, federally, you know, it's mandated that the strike ends. And, you know, they still took 2 years to get a CBA in place. But we saw how that changed the game over time. But I think you look at service time manipulation, the fact that the top first and second in each league's rookie of the year will receive a full year of service time. So even if you try to play the game where you delay it 2 weeks or you try to delay Super 2 status to you know, late May or June or whenever the specific time is, if that player rakes and is first or second in rookie of the year, they get a full year of service time. So you have that. I think the other one that might be a little more enticing for teams is if you promote a top prospect to the opening day roster, you can get draft picks if they finish top three in rookie of the year, or top five in MVP or Cy Young. The latter there, unlikely. You know, you typically don't see a rookie do that, but top three in rookie of the year, that's certainly a nice incentive. I mean, if Adley Rutschman's as good as advertised, you'd like to think if he's on the opening day roster, there's a pretty good chance he can be top three in rookie of the year. Now, I don't love
player's personal performance in a good way can earn you draft capital. You can earn
sure
a draft pick.
But if that gets us to the point where we're not playing quite as many of these ridiculous service time games, then I'm all for it. Now, the part of it I don't like bestowing that responsibility on the Baseball Writers Association. Yeah. I think we've seen how that's played out with Hall of Fame voting as it being very problematic. And, you know, I'm not saying I know what the perfect solution would be there. You know, do you come up with a statistical formula? Some people, you know, one of the things that had been talked about throughout the negotiations was using wins above replacement, for example, in terms of, you know, bonuses and things of that nature for pre-arbitration players. But I like seeing that. So you had that with the service time standpoint. I'll give you the other off the radar one. You know, and so much has been talked about the fact that, you know, there's a lot of discussion that they're going to have increased base sizes. They're going to limit shifts. They're going to do some things like that. And look, we've talked about all those elements of the game. But I'll tell you one that's a little bit off the beaten path that I think is not going to make a difference right now. But if you're looking in a big picture sense, it's something that I like to see. It was limiting the number of times a player can be optioned in a season to 5. And I'll tell you why. This game has become
all the rule, right?
It's that. But this game has become, it's all about max effort. These pitchers are coming in and throwing as hard as they possibly can. That's why, you know, I hear more traditional, old school kind of fans say, you know, oh, hit the ball the other way and different elements of that. And I'll hear that. But at the same time, you think about pitchers of previous eras, they were not, Jim Palmer wasn't going out there and throwing max effort for 9,500 pitches and then he's done. I mean, it was very much more of a stamina game and, you know, you paced yourself. Certainly you reared up, you reared back and fired when you needed to in a big spot. But we know that this game has become all about max effort. Throw as hard as you can, swing as hard as you can. So when you have something in place like limiting the number of times players can be optioned, we've seen this, middle relief. You said it, Buck Showalter and Dan Duquette were, you know, kind of ahead of the curve. There were other teams doing it 10 years ago, but they were very much ahead of the curve there in terms of having optionable bullpen pieces and middle relievers and cycling through not just a pitching rotation, but an entire staff, an entire organization of pitching. And guys at AAA, and we talked about the Norfolk Shuttle, and you know, guys like Kevin Gausman who are going back and forth on that for years even. But when you start to implement some things that limit the amount of flexibility you have, I think that forces teams. And again, do I think 5 times per year, you know, for an optionable player is going to make a major dent right now? Probably not. But when you look at that, you look at the fact that from what I understand, the injured list is going to go back to 15 days from 10 days for pitchers. I think you have less of that manipulation where you say, oh, well, we'll just throw this guy out here for 3 innings and then we're going to send them back to the minors. You'll still see that, but you're going to see a little bit less of that. And I think the more and more you do things of that nature, I think it causes teams to reassess how they approach their pitching. And I know, and I don't want to give credit for this, Joe Sheehan, longtime baseball writer, has his own newsletter, wrote for SI for years. He's actually talked about capping the number of pitchers on a roster for the very reason of saying, hey, it can't be max effort because we can't have, you know, we only have X number of pitchers. I mean, you see these rosters now, 26-man rosters when 14 pitchers. I mean, it's absurd. So if you have a mechanism in place of a total number of a limit of pitchers on your roster for each game, you know, maybe you do something over the course of a week or 2 weeks, or I don't know exactly how you'd structure it, but the idea that you limit the number of pitchers available to you, and that really forces you to reevaluate how you train, how you approach a 162 game season. And I think that, as much as banning the shift or pitch clock or all these different other things, and look, I'm not opposed to other mechanisms, but if you want to really talk about trying to fundamentally shift the game back to having more action, more balls put in play, things of that nature, I think capping the number of pitchers you can use would really go a long way in doing that. And I see that, you know, that option limit that they're introducing this year, I feel like that's a start. Again, that's not going to move the meter this year. I don't want anyone listening right now predicting that, you know, Luke's saying that the game's going to fundamentally change for the better in 2022. I just feel like a step like that could be a move in the right direction of some, you know, a little more legitimate moves that I suggested down the line that, you know, limit the number of pitchers available per game, you know, and even with that, you could have something in place where you have a couple standby arms if you go into extra innings. I'm not saying, you know, put pitchers in danger. I'm saying, can we do some things to get this game back where it was in terms of pitching 15, 20 years ago, at least. It's not going back to the way it was 60 years ago. Let's be clear.
Well, they had a negotiation. Can we do something that maybe didn't have a competition committee meeting? You know what I mean?
Right. Like, sure. Well, and that's what's, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that's something that's been so frustrating to me through this whole process. Is you look at the elements over which they're fighting, and so much of it's obviously economic. Well, I understand that. I mean, there's a lot of money being made, and the players wanted to get their share, and you know, billionaires typically don't want to give up their, you know, a bigger share of it. But you just said it. There's so much about this game that needs to be addressed in terms of making the game itself better from an aesthetic standpoint on a nightly basis, making it more appealing to watch. I've said to you over and over, as much as I respect the intellectual evolution of the game and, you know, what we're seeing in terms of analytics, what we see in terms of science and technology and player tracking to make more efficient baseball players, that has not aligned with making the game more entertaining to watch. And that's a major problem, of course. You know, that's, you know, it's such a simplistic idea, but that's a big part of the problem right now. So
you
again,
change the flavor of your food.
Right. but at the same time, I don't want to completely stifle what has been some intellectual evolution. Like, I don't want to see shifts banned entirely. Is there a way to limit it a little bit? Sure. But do I think that banning shifts are going to fix the game in terms of lack of balls put in play? No, because I think what you're seeing players do has been a response to pitchers throwing as hard as they can. And these guys with technology on their side to develop, you know, breaking pitches that have, you know, and, you know, talk about spin rate and release point and all the different things they can track now. Whereas before it was needing to have a really good pitching coach who had a really good eye and feel for those types of things. You know, it's all so scientific now, which again, I don't want to say is a bad thing, but when it's resulted in a game that is not as easy on the eyes to watch, that's where I have concerns. So that's where I look at something like saying, okay, this Norfolk shuttle or, you know, whatever your AAA team is, let's limit this a little bit. And I think that's a good start. But like I said, in a long-term sense, there are two things I think can help the game in terms of pitching, you know, talking about the pitching being too good and all of that. One, it would be to cap the rosters. Two, and this is the one that's way more problematic and much tougher to implement because of the injury at risk factor, is potentially moving the mound back 6 inches, a foot and a half, whatever it might be, just because the velocity has just gotten so out of control. So I'd rather look at capping the roster size in terms of pitchers before we go down that other road, because I think moving the mound back, that's, you know, moving the rubber back, that's something you're talking about livelihood and injury risk.
Yeah, how will we ever get a vote on that? How will we ever figure that out, right? Slow to move.
Right.
They finally got the DH, so I want to get that in after 30 minutes of baseball conversation. I saw that my boy Nelly Cruz is going to make some dough down there, get some national money, get himself some Expos money. How about that?
A long time coming, and look, maybe it's just because you and I are American League guys, you know, grew up in an American League market, but I'm so glad we're not going to have to hear anyone complain about, oh, the double switch. It's such brilliant strategy. No, it's not. It's really not that difficult. And the idea for every Mike Hampton, or, you know, when Bartolo Colon hit that home run in San Diego, or, you know, the handful of pitchers that have been able to rake over the last 20 years, been a lot of automatic outs and a lot of really, really embarrassingly bad at bats, and
a lot of inning killers.
Yeah, I'm, and on the flip side, more National League pitchers are going to have a chance to go a little bit deeper in games now. You're going to see less pinch hitting in the fourth and fifth inning. Not that guys go that deep anymore, anyway. But I think that will help a little bit. So I was glad to see that. I think 2 years ago when we saw the pandemic shortened year, the writing was on the wall that we were going to see that. I just thought it was funny that the Major League Baseball, the owners, tried to view that as some kind of like great player win, even though both sides wanted that. But they tried to make it a player centric thing. But was glad to see that. And again, we'll have to find a way to carry on without seeing those pitchers batting 089 every year.
You know, it makes me want to call Leo Mazzoni and have say, "Oh, my guys could hit. Oh my, they didn't have to worry about relief pitchers. Hell, they didn't need a relief pitcher." That's pretty good, though, Leo.
The great commercial back from the 90s, Chicks Dig the Long Ball. Remember that? Glavin and Maddox, batting practice, all that. I will miss that, but again, I will not miss seeing pitchers, especially Orioles pitchers, trying to hit in National League ballparks. No thanks.
Speaking of Orioles pitchers, I want to give a special shout out from the heart to Jimmy Poole. I put a social media blurb out. Jim threw me a text back. Jim is battling ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and Jim was my first ever co-host who actually came and hung out and took March Madness picks with me because he liked basketball in Georgia Tech. So big shout out to Jim Poole, who has been in communication with me and may be coming on the program sometime soon. So we certainly wish for the best for him. Luke Jones can be found anywhere the internet travels at Baltimore Luke. You'll be in Facebook and Twitter and the Instagrams and anywhere but spring training, and probably sending you out breaking news on the Coons 4 tech service as the Ravens go out and sign players, and Tom Brady's back, and it's football season, although you never know it around here. I'm Nestor. He's Luke. We are WNSD, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking. Baltimore, positive.